I see art as an opportunity for me to make a loud, resounding statement, and based on that statement, to create conversation and dialogue around whatever the issue is. So when I'm writing, when I'm painting, when I'm drawing, when I'm designing something, I'm doing it intentionally, you know, from the standpoint of trying to create dialogue and conversation that ultimately will bring us together. I want you to love my work or hate it. I'm upset if you're indifferent to it, if you can just walk by it and not see or feel anything. But if you hate it, I did my job. If you love it, I did my job. Because now I forced you to stand on something.
From the McCourtney Institute for Democracy on the campus of Penn State University, I'm Michael Berkman.
And I'm Chris Beam.
And I'm Jenna Spinelli. And welcome to Democracy Works!
So, Jenna, you took a trip to Baltimore.
I did. I went down to Charm City to speak with Aaron Maben, who is a Penn State alum. You may recognize his name from his time on the Penn State football field or in the NFL. Played for the Buffalo Bills and several other teams
NFL career. Yeah.
But now he is back in his hometown of Baltimore, working as a public school teacher in West Baltimore and teaching art to students there. And he's also maintains an active art studio and has what I thought was a really interesting perspective on the relationship between
has a book.
And, you know, kind of the thread tying all of these things together is his thoughts on the relationship between art and activism, which is the title of his book. And I just think that he, based on his background and the work that he's doing, brings a really interesting perspective to what we often think about as very abstract kind of issues.
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's understand here. This is an incredibly accomplished athlete. Also an incredibly accomplished artist, right? I mean, he teaches art, but he's also, you know, really made a name for himself as an artist. And, you know, that alone is extremely impressive. But the fact that he's in addition to this, decided to go back to, you know, the central city in Baltimore and teach underserved children. About art and using art as a way to kind of educate them about politics, about social justice issues,
yeah, and about race issues, and all very locally oriented. I mean, I think from a perspective of things we've talked about on this show, that's where I see some of what he does as most interesting. Is this sort of this local focus on being active in the community, on trying to affect change at the community level, on the importance of involving local community people in representation, in politics, in policymaking.
He also speaks to the fact that this is not easy. I mean, talk about someone out there doing the hard work of democracy.
Right. So this is as an individual who has gone back to the community that he grew up in, right? It is a lower class community. It's mostly African American, impoverished. A lot of these kids don't go on to college, and he is using art as a way to develop these students' consciousness, to let them understand what social justice means, and for our purposes, how you understand your role as a citizen, as a participant in this democracy, to effectuate the kind of change you want to see, that you need in your community.
So it was interesting too, and I'm really glad that I went to Baltimore to do this interview, because Aaron was really in his element. And you know, Baltimore is in some ways a flawed city. It certainly had its share of problems over the years, and he's one of the people out there trying to work to make things better.
Well, and you know, in many ways, Baltimore is typical of dare I say, every American city, right? That there are parts of it that are thriving. There's amazing things in Baltimore, you know, public works and new development, but then there's also a part of that town, part of that city, that is completely removed from that and that is struggling both economically and also in terms of just prospects for people growing up there. And, you know, Aaron has a lot of strong opinions about how you go about identifying the problems and then moving towards a solution.
So the kind of work he's doing is important because he's reaching people that are in many ways disenfranchised from the political system.
And certainly, I mean, and that's how they feel right. about their point, their condition, their
yeah.
status.
And so he's able to come down in a kind of unconventional way and talk about social justice issues and talk about issues that could be addressed politically to people that may not be thinking about things that way.
Right. And telling them that they have power,
right.
but in order to use it, they have to you know, develop some skills and learn
right.
about how to do it.
Okay, let's go to the interview.
All right, yep. Here's my interview with Aaron Maben. This is Jenna Spinelli here today with Aaron Maben. Aaron, thank you for joining us on Democracy Works.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm going to talk today all about your art activism work. But before we get to that, I think people may recognize your name from your time either playing football at Penn State or in the NFL. I can't think of two more different universes than professional sports and the work that you're doing now here in Baltimore. Can you talk about what that transition was like and how you came to find your voice as an activist?
The transition was, it was a whole journey in and of itself, but I'd be doing it a disservice if I didn't act like from the beginning, you know, my work here in the city of Baltimore wasn't always a big priority for me. I started my foundation in 2009, my rookie year, before I even got drafted. But even growing up here in the city of Baltimore, you know, from growing up in a family that was really rooted not just in the church, but in, you know, doing community work, community service, grassroots organizing. My father being an organizer of men and somebody who, from a community level, always wanted to see change and be a part of that change, really kind of groomed me into the man that I've become. But it did come to a point in my career where I realized that I was at like a crossroads moment. And I kind of felt as though at this point, if I'm going to become the type of athlete that I always envision myself being, I'm going to have to take a step back from the art, from the community stuff, from the writing, from all of it, and just focus this all of my energy completely on the game, my body, my regimen, all of that kind of stuff. And then on the other side of the coin, if I was going to really have the kind of impact in my community that I wanted to have, really touch and impact people's lives in the way that I saw myself being able to do, I was going to have to step away from the game that I had loved my entire life, you know? So that was a big journey for me, but I definitely can't say that I regret the decision that I've made. I'm prouder now of the work that I'm doing and the impact that I'm having in people's lives and, you know, on my city in general. I'm prouder than that than anything that I ever did as an athlete.
So tell us about your teaching work and how that integrates into your organizing and your activism overall.
I started my foundation, Project Mayhem, in 2009. And it's an arts-based foundation, but really most of the work that we've done has been centered in the arts, but also education. And, you know, obviously, with me being an artist, that was something that I've always been passionate about. And a year and a half before I was drafted, there were major budget cuts in the city of Baltimore in the school system. And basically, their budget was cut in half, essentially. And the first programs usually that are cut when a school faces funding issues like that are typically your arts and music programs, unfortunately. So what we did with my foundation is we started going into certain schools that were under that category and supplementing those workshops and curricula ourselves. So I was doing art workshops and programming at schools all across the city, starting in 2009. By 2010, 2011, I realized how naive I was as like a 20-year-old rookie coming into the league, thinking that like this contract that I'm gonna get is gonna be enough for me to like fix all the problems in my city. Like it sounds crazy to say, but when you're that young and ambitious and all of that kind of stuff, you're really ignorant enough to believe that you're gonna be able to do that yourself.
Yeah, well, you know? but if you hadn't had that grand vision, you know, I wonder how that would have impacted where you ended up.
Yeah, that's a good point to bring up. But you know, when I came to the understanding that essentially I did not have the resources, I didn't have the funding, I didn't have any of the things necessary to fill in that gap for all of the schools that fell under that umbrella at that point in time. The lion's share of my time, energy, and resources then shifted to advocacy and the grassroots organizing around those issues to see funding brought to these schools in other ways that could ultimately be devoted to, you know, the arts and music programs. And I was still doing my workshops and programming and things like that, but I got that understanding of, you know, yeah, you can go and you can do a workshop at a school for 2 and 3 days. You know, you can go and you and the kids can have this amazing experience and these great breakthroughs. But at the end of this 2 to 3 day time, you go back to your life and they go back to the same business as usual environment that they had before you got there. So ultimately, everybody was giving me praise for the work that I was doing, but I didn't feel like anything was actually getting done.
Sure.
So fast forward a few years, still working heavily on, you know, the advocacy and legislative policy side of things, but not really seeing the kind of progress that I wanted to see. So many things I would see and have a problem with, and you know, you tweet about it, you show up at town halls and meetings and you raise hell and you know, you talk about it on, you know, different news programs and everything, but nothing really happens, you know. And I got to the point where I was a little bit fed up, and I at this point had retired and had been, you know, doing my artwork and community organizing full time for about like a year and a half. So at that point, I had already been doing workshops and programming at different schools around the city, but there was no organized kind of effort behind it. There was no concrete program that was established that we could really get the kind of quantitative data that allows you to be able to show people how viable it is. So I made a decision. I said, you know, you can only really sit on the sidelines for so long talking about how bad something is until it's actually time to roll up your sleeves and get your own hands dirty fixing the problem. So I said, all right, I've got to find a school, one school that I can plant myself in and actually hammer out this curriculum and see over the course of a year, 2 years, you know, what we can accomplish with the same group of kids over an extended period of time. Now we're finishing up my third year teaching. You know, so I've been with the same group of kids. I've seen kids leave my school letter in middle school now. I've seen kids go from, you know, kindergarten that are now getting ready to go into their fourth and fifth grade years, you know. So that was really important, you know. And once I got in that position, it really just opened everything up, you know. Lesson planning wise, I was able to really introduce some dynamic methods of educating and interacting with them that they had never been exposed to before. And on the flip side of it, some of the deficiencies that were present in the school building before I got there, in the actual area, we've been able over that amount of time to address. And not everything is perfect or fixed or anything like that, but since I've gotten there, you can actually see the progress that we've made. And that's the thing that, you know, really gets me excited about doing this work now, because you can actually see the fruits of your labor on a daily basis.
Sure. And this I think speaks to something that you talk about in your book, Art Activism, which is the difference between activism and organizing. You touched on it somewhat before when you're talking about the difference between tweeting and going on the news versus actually getting in there and getting your hands dirty.
Yeah, so, I mean, we live in a time where everybody wants to be trending. You know, if there's a topic that's trending, everybody wants to weigh in on it. If there's a situation that goes viral or that gets a certain amount of national attention, everybody wants to weigh in. But at the end of the day, like, how much do you really think this tweet is getting? You know what I mean? Like, I can tweet about, you know, Flint not having water all day. But unless I'm actually got boots on the ground up there that I'm sending water to, that I'm advocating for, that I know that this petition that I'm signing is something that this whole community is behind. You know, like, we're doing what we feel like is the work. And that's the self-gratification part of it, you know, when you can tweet and you get a bunch of retweets and everybody's saying, yeah, that's right, you know, but where's the follow-up to that? You know what I mean? Like, once we tweet, once we march, once we raise hell, where is the follow-up that actually gets the legislative policy changes that we say that we want? Where is the accountability that we talk about not being there? You know, how are we going about getting these things that are kind of becoming like sound bites to everybody that considers themselves to be an activist, or all of these social justice warriors on Twitter and IG, which I'm not coming against these people, because all of these things have their place. And it's like without you know, talk taking place on social media, you don't have as much attention around these issues. My thing is, once we have attention, what are we doing with that attention? How are we leveraging this attention towards finding solutions, usable solutions to whatever the problems may be? And I think that sometimes people get lost after the part where you tweet or you march, or you know what I mean? Like you show up and you protest, like, what follows the protest?
Yeah, and I think what oftentimes follows is a lot of long, hard hours, hard work, slow meetings, slow change.
The cameras aren't around for that.
Yeah, though. Yeah. So how did you learn to navigate those processes? You mentioned public policy a couple times, so, you know, navigating the bureaucracy and all the different personalities and like the power grabs and all those kind of things.
You just have to educate yourself. And that's something that, you know, it's not really the sexy answer to a question like that, but it's the answer that everybody needs to hear. You know, you can't just be on social media and, you know, follow CNN or, you know, MSNBC, you know, and think that you're up on, you know, what's going on politically. You can't just watch the news and think that you're informed on what's happening politically. You know, we no longer teach civics in school anymore. You know, so when you're just talking about people's civic responsibilities, most people don't have an understanding of what they are and what that even means. So when you talk about voting, when you talk about actually showing up to city hall and, you know, city council meetings and even your local district, how involved are you in local politics, which is much more important than, you know, national politics? You know, I always say state before federal. You know, because what happens in your city, what happens in your state is going to impact you tomorrow.
Oh, sure.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you need to know what's going on locally in your political scene. And most of us don't. And I'm not saying that to come at any. I've been one of these people most of my life. And this is with connections to people through my father and other mentors of mine who were in the game. So if that's me, then, you know, your average person who never knew a politician or never was in any of these rooms definitely is behind the curveball. So we have to go about the process of educating ourselves as to not only like what our rights are, but how we go about changing unjust laws, how we go about combating systemic injustice when we see it, and really understanding that it's about much more than just raising hell on the issue. The follow-up has to be there. We have to have actual tangible steps that we're working towards and processes and planning on how to get there. And that's usually where we end up dropping the ball. So and really, like, I'm a better example than most people, because, you know, I was a guy that, you know, when I was younger, used to brag about not voting. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, this whole process is corrupt. This is that. You know, this whole system is messed up. It's not for us. Like, I'm not going to vote. I didn't even realize how ignorant about that opinion was until I went and educated myself on what my civic duty and responsibility is and why me participating in that process is so important. You know, why the amount of people not voting is almost what allows unjust laws and unjust social constructs to exist in the first place. You know, so once we have an understanding of that, we move a little bit different. So, you know, as I went through that process of educating myself, I just try to pass that along. You know, I don't try to be stingy with knowledge once I get it. You know, I pass that along to the people that I mentor. I pass that along to my students that I teach. I pass that along to their parents sometimes because even, you know, some of our parents need to understand more about what their civic duty is.
Sure, you know? Sure. And you've also talked about the importance of having voices from the community at the table in terms of being in office, running for city council, holding these types of offices. Do you think that someone needs to be from a community in order to affect the greatest amount of change there? Or I guess
I'm a stickler for language. So if you're saying the greatest change, yeah, I do think that a person that's gonna create the greatest change is probably going to be a person that comes from there, you know. And that's not saying that great ideas can't come from outsiders and all of that kind of stuff, because sometimes you can get too isolated in your bubble, you know what I mean? But I think that too often the people that are in positions to make the decisions that really affect the lives of the people that live in these areas, the constituents that truly need to be represented, if you don't come from there and you're not even making the effort to connect with and understand these people, how can you say that you represent them? You know, and I think that too oftentimes we go for the polished and proper, you know, candidate that presents themselves as opposed to the person that we know, the person that we watched grow up, the person that we understood through their maturation process as an adult. And I think that more than anything, once we have a relationship with a person and you know that you can work with them, you know that they have an understanding of the issues that they're advocating for, you believe in them. You know, you feel like, all right, I'm invested in this process because this person is invested in me.
So what role can people, so say someone listening to this who lives in California or even in Australia or, you know, wherever it is across the U.S. or throughout the world, they see what's happening, things that concern them in Baltimore or, you know, other places throughout the country. What role should or could outsiders play, do you think?
I don't think there's anything wrong with outsiders coming in and sharing their resources. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I think I don't have a problem with outsiders. You know, like, that's my thing. It's like, in Baltimore, we can kind of give that perception where, like, we don't like outsiders. What I'm not anti-outsider. I'm anti-outsiders coming in and trying to be in leadership positions saying, all right, I'm going to come in and hood and save these disenfranchised poor folk. You know what I mean? That don't know how to save themselves. It's like, no, these people know exactly what they need. But they need resources in order to get those things. So if you're a person with money, then donate some of your money to an organization that's already here that's doing great work. We don't need you to come in and create your own organization. You don't know what you're doing. You know what I'm saying? If you have a job, then if you have a plug on jobs, then let's reach out to some of the people in these disenfranchised communities and see how we can connect some of them to jobs or jobs training. You know, if you have connections business-wise to loans or to even people that can walk you through those early stages of entrepreneurship, then let's set up some mentorship opportunities and some apprenticeship opportunities. You know, you don't have to be the savior, you know, to do good work. And I think oftentimes we feel like, well, I have to create the foundation that's going to do this, or I have to create the organization that's going to get this done. That organization already exists. And if somebody would actually support that organization, then the work that they're doing would be 10 times greater. But don't come here and tell me that you want to tell us how to advocate for ourselves in legislative policy efforts. Like, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle is already doing that. So you can donate some to them and they'll do their thing. Don't come here and tell us that you want to work on, you know, reforming the police department. You got no boundaries that's already doing that over here. Like, support the work that they're doing. Because we in the community, we know them. We trust them. We don't trust these outsiders that are coming in, that are bringing outsiders to hire them into these positions and then coming out, you know, handing out a cup of waters on a hot day and, you know, asking you to sign up and get their mail-in letter. And then next thing you know, they're getting, you know, millions of dollars of federal funding to do what this organization over here has been doing for 20 years.
Yeah. Do you ever think you'd run for office?
Nah. I get asked that every day, but that's not... I feel like the work that I do is more effective because people know that that's not what I want. You know what I mean? Like, you got every year you got 100 people that want to be mayor. You know what I mean? Like, I just want to make my city better.
Right.
And at the end of the day, that requires me not having the best relationship with the mayor at that point in time. It might, you know, require me holding a couple of our people on city council accountable, you know, but I'm in a very unique position where there are very few people that can exert any kind of power or control over me, you know? So if there's something I feel like needs to be said, I'm saying it. If there's something I feel like needs to be done, I'm doing it. I'm not worried about the consequences or repercussions because I'm not beholden to anybody. And I think that once you involve yourself in politics, regardless of how clean you try to keep yourself, that's just not a realistic, you know, it's not a realistic perspective.
Right. So let's switch gears and talk about art for a minute.
Absolutely.
So podcasts are an inherently non-visual medium. we'll link to your book
for our social media folks. If you Google Aaron Maven Art or hashtag it on any of your social media platforms, you should see a bunch of my stuff come up. I put out a lot of content, so you know it's pretty easy to find.
Yeah. Can you to the best that you can try to describe your aesthetic, kind of your overall vision for your work, where that comes from?
Honestly, I think the title of my book is what describes it best. You know, when you talk about art activism, it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But to me, it means using multidimensional forms of art, whatever forms that may be, whether it be literature, whether it be poetry, whether it be music, whether it be visual art, whether it be photography, as a tool. You know, as a weapon, essentially, to fight social justice battles. You know, understanding the power of narrative, understanding the power of the spoken word, understanding that a picture says 1,000 words, you know, and the impact that an image can have, the visceral impact that it can have on someone. How do you use that as a tool to educate people? You know, how do you use that as a tool to encourage and bring about empathy and understanding? You know, how do you use that as a tool to connect folk? The analogy I like giving people is, if I put a painting up on this wall right here, you know, and the three of us in this room, we stand around this painting, all three of us are gonna see and feel something different that's specific to us, regardless of the fact that, you know, two of the people in this room are black and one is white, regardless of the fact that, you know, I'm from here, you're from here, you're from here. Like, we'll figure out that there's a million miles between your world and mine. But the space between us is the space that allows us to grow if we let it. You know, so I see art as an opportunity for me to make a loud, resounding statement. And based on that statement, to create conversation and dialogue around whatever the issue is. So when I'm writing, when I'm painting, when I'm drawing, when I'm designing something, I'm doing it intentionally, you know, from the standpoint of trying to create dialogue and conversation that ultimately will bring us together. Because if I create artwork that you can't be lukewarm about, that you have to feel one way or another, I want you to love my work or hate it. I'm upset if you're indifferent to it, if you can just walk by it and not see or feel anything. But if you hate it, I did my job. If you love it, I did my job. Because now I forced you to stand on something. What do you believe? And if I'm dead wrong, why am I wrong? And if I'm right, then why am I right? You know what I mean? Like, but the conversation that comes from the artwork is what I'm trying to create in the content that I put out.
We were talking earlier about how you see the young people that you're working with, and that's this kind of movement that's been happening for several years here in Baltimore as being the start of a new renaissance.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about where you see things going?
Onward and upward. You know, I think that being a student of history, I've always been a fan of, like, you know, different renaissance periods in human history. Obviously, the Harlem Renaissance and, like, the Black Arts Movement are probably, like, the two staples for me between, like, those two and, like, the Black Power Movement that took place in the 60s and 70s. So as a student of how those movements were created, you know, I'd be a fool if I wasn't able to sit back and realize, wow, like, it's actually happening again. You know, on a daily basis, I'm surrounded by people who will be talked about for generations to come. You know, best-selling authors and nationally renowned dancers and poets and painters and art and rap artists and visual artists and photographers. You know, I can name the Dee Watkins and the Devin Allens and the Kyle Yearwoods and the A1 Chops, the musicians, and, like, you know, the Moo Moo Freshes, the Eazy-E. Like, it's so many people that are just amazing, brilliant creatives, and that are finally, after years of beating on their craft, getting national acclaim, you know, and being celebrated on those national stages. It's a lot different than when we were kids and somebody put, you know, Huckleberry Finn in our hands and expected us to really to feel that. Like, no, we're not feeling that. We don't see ourselves in this. This isn't how we talk. This isn't our dialect. This isn't our surroundings. Like, we don't know this life that this author is trying to articulate. But the struggles, you know, the struggles breed some of the most amazing art. And you saw that in the Harlem Renaissance, where, you know, Black folks in Harlem were struggling. But, you know, out of that struggle came a beauty that, you know, to this day, we still look back at in awe. And I think that you're seeing a lot of the same things taking place in Baltimore right now. And I count myself as privileged to be a part of that.
Oh, for sure. So can you talk a little bit more about the process for developing that curriculum? And did you receive any pushback from the school from the district or individual schools
so,
as you're trying to implement it?
Yes and no. The beautiful thing about, I can't say that it's all beautiful. Mm-hmm. One of the good things about Baltimore's school system is, you know, they do have site-based budgets. So if a principal is feeling it, you know what I mean? Like, it's happening. I got tired of seeing it done the wrong way. You know, every few years we dress up the same curricula that, you know, has existed for years as something different, you know, and you know, spoon feed it back to our kids like they can't tell that it's the same old leftovers from a couple days ago. You know what I mean? And it's not hitting them. It's not reaching them. They don't see themselves in it. They don't feel affirmed by it. They don't have an understanding of how it's really going to affect and shape their lives. And in the curriculum, I walk the educators through how to facilitate the dialogue and the discussions that come from the questions. And there's some hardball questions in there. It's stuff that we're introducing at a middle and a high school level, and even an elementary school level in some cases, that I wasn't forced to wrestle with until I was in college or a grown man outside of college. You know, so my question to myself as I was creating it was, what would it look like to have a generation of youth that were even more socially, economically, spiritually, intellectually competent than even we were at their age? You know, how do we start to introduce these ideas of injustice, racism, sexism, patriarchy, you know, all of these things that are big issues to us as human beings. But as adults, most of us are already behind the eight ball because we've been incubated in a society that never attacked these things at a root level at an early age. But what if we could facilitate these discussions in a safe space in our schools, you know, with educators that are socially competent enough to really understand what these kids are going through and really force them to become critical thinkers and to become the architects of their own solutions? You know, so I created the curriculum about a year and a half ago, And we were able to implement it at my school and several schools across the city early on. And now it's really picking up.
Yeah, that's so smart. I feel like there's so many places even outside of schools where this
absolutely
this type of approach could work. So we talked at the very beginning about civics education. If you were going to put together a similar model for introducing or perhaps reintroducing the civics education kind of in this same model, what types of things would you
We're
would
actually
you
include? In the process of doing that right
oh,
now.
Wow.
So it's some stuff that I can't necessarily speak on at the moment, but we've got a lot of civic engagement projects that we're about to roll out, especially coming into this election year. It's really important that more than any time period that we've ever lived in, this is the time not for us to be advocating for anybody to vote for a particular candidate, but for us to be educating each other about what that process is, how you actually, organize around the issues that we want to see changed, and lobby to make sure that whoever's in office has to do what their job is and what's necessary to see those changes through. So I see it as being a situation where we have to go district by district throughout the whole city and actually have informative sessions that walk people through different steps of the civic engagement process. Like, how do we make sure that the trash gets picked up in our neighborhood? How do we make sure that that this grievance that we have with this officer who's always here persecuting our young boys on the corner, hold him accountable? How do we make sure that our schools are actually getting the funding and the attention and the resources that they need in order for our students to be successful? All of these things are things that we can be working on a daily basis in our communities. And we do have people that are working on these very issues every single day. But if the entire city, if every single community had a real understanding of what they can do on a day-to-day basis, even if it's just making sure that they're calling their politicians every single day to make sure that their grievances are recorded and documented.
I have one last question for you. What does democracy mean to you?
To me, democracy is a beautiful idea, but it's an idea. And with any idea, you have to work constantly to manifest it. And even once some of that work is done and you feel like progress has been made, the beauty of democracy is we have to go back and we have to continuously self-evaluate and see if we're on the right side of history. And I think that the more that we have a true understanding of what democracy is, the better Americans will all be.
Yeah, that's a great note to end. I can think of no better example of someone who is both doing the hard work and self-reflection and, putting it all together and helping others do the same thing. So, Aaron, thank you very much for your time today and for joining us on Democracy Works.
Thank you for having me.
This is Chris and Michael. We're back. I think it's really interesting, Michael, to hear him talk about this kind of distinction between activism and organizing. And I really think, his experience is...
Well, and it's confusing, right? Because he doesn't like to call himself an activist. He calls himself an organizer.
Yeah.
Is that right? But the title of his book is Art Activism.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, it is, I guess what I would, I would phrase his point of view is that activism on its own is insufficient.
No, you need the ongoing, continuous work of organizing. And it's consistent with his overall definition of democracy that he gave a really rich definition, to Jenna.
It's really, really good definition.
It's an idea, and with any idea, you have to work constantly to manifest it, even when some of that work is done and you feel like progress has been made, you need to go back.
And that is not sexy. He's right. And that is not, there's no cameras when you're doing that. But if you're not willing to do that, you're probably not going to have much impact.
But he's also very clear on not wanting to run for office.
Yeah.
And his take on not wanting to run for office is really quite interesting because he says it's basically the people that I want to represent don't have money.
That's part of it. And the other thing
and so in order to be in office, you need to be supported by money.
Right.
And that money
and
is.
And the people who have the money.
And that is essentially what he said. Most of the people I know that would be my biggest supporters are living paycheck to paycheck. So who's supposed to give me this money?
I would argue against the idea that because they don't have money, therefore, it's hopeless to run for office. It's harder. But that may make it all the more necessary. And when you have the opportunity for somebody who genuinely cares about their community and genuinely wants to use politics to make it better, mm-hmm. that's the kind of person you want in politics.
Yeah. So we also have some interesting things to say about federalism and about some of the long-term conflicts that have existed in major programs to try to funnel money from federal government to communities that need it.
What do you do about poverty? How do you best address the problems?
So who makes those decisions? Right. Should mm-hmm. they be made locally or should they mm-hmm. be made mm-hmm. at the federal level? I know, for example, Great Society programs wrestled with this because on the one hand, they were categorical programs where money was given for very specific uses. On the other hand, they also tried to encourage a sort of maximum feasible participation where local officials would have local communities would have some say in what happened with the money. But then more conservative proposals like revenue sharing just gave money over to public officials. It was largely spent on police and public safety and didn't address some of the other kinds of concerns. So without going into a big dissertation about different kinds of federalism programs, this is an ongoing challenge in a federalist system. It's the federal government has the capacity to raise far more money than, for example, the city of Baltimore does or even sure. the state of Maryland, and to give that out around the country where it's needed. But then, as Mabin is saying, you really enter into these problems about who best knows how money should be spent. And he's saying it's people like him
yeah.
who are working locally, who are from the community, who understand the community.
Yeah, I mean, this is a perennial problem, and I came across it in philanthropy too. I mean, you have people who are sincere about trying to make things better, and there are also people who try to employ the latest knowledge from social science about what works and what doesn't, and it often runs up against what the reality is on the ground and in the community. It's a perennial problem and intractable in many ways. So I think it's interesting that he was talking about, trying to develop this kind of civics curriculum, which I think is a really good idea. And, we've talked about how, badly our generation has failed younger Americans in that regard. But I also think it's worth pointing out that, basically his political strategy, his means for achieving or improving social justice is through education. It's through using art and his art to connect to young people, to excite them about their own potential, their own standing
but
as an individual
but
and
also
as a
about
citizen.
The problems in their community.
Right.
Yeah, I was intrigued by what he had to say, that he's got some ideas and plans for working on civics education. Didn't say much to Jenna about what that was.
Well, when he's got it up and running, we'll have him back on, because I think, we both feel like this is a really important and
Or bring him to campus. Great guy.
Great
person for us. Students to meet.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, mm-hmm. That'd be great. And thanks to Aaron for his time and for his service. For the McCourtney Institute for Democracy, I'm Chris Beam.
I'm Michael Berkman.
Thanks for listening.